You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
And we're going to do this in a conversational style, and I actually encourage participation from the audience. First, just two words on myself. My name is Mike Mandel. I'm the former chief economist at Businessweek. I'm now, I got a lot of different hats. One hat is that I'm affiliated with the Progressive Policy Institute, where I run the Innovation and Regulation Project there. I also have a venture startup up in New York, doing a combination of news and education. And the two authors next to me, very impressive. One is Kevin Manny, okay, author, journalist, and thinker. Okay, he agreed that this was my description of him, okay, but he agreed that this was an okay one. And off of my far right, it's Gary Shapiro, CEO of the Consumer Electronics Association, and I guess best-selling author now. It's good. So does everybody have a copy of, you didn't have copies of your book. Does everybody have a copy of Gary's book? Hold up your book, please. All right. Good. It's a great photo here. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be asking Gary and it's good. Okay. I'm going to be asking Gary and Kevin questions, and then I'm going to be taking along the way questions from the audience. And feel free, if there's something that you feel extremely passionate about, to jump up and interrupt. And if it's not a good time, I'll let you know. Okay, Gary, let's start with you. Okay, we have...
Thank you first for having me, and thank you all for coming. I think the challenge we face as a nation is that we've had a very good thing. We've had a strategy as a country which wasn't explicit, and it was that we are going to attract the best and the brightest. Genetically, we all come from people who wanted a better life, and they came here. We have a First Amendment that encourages people to dissent and push back against the status quo. And we've succeeded as a nation because we have more than 100-year history of being the best in the world and being a magnet for entrepreneurs and for those who think they can do it better by definition. So, and that's worked very well. And I think the turning point for me, I think, was September 11, 2001, when all of a sudden we changed a lot of our strategy. And the first thing we did, and I was on the board of George Mason University then, and boy, we saw a drop-off in the number of international student applications. Not only were we not getting them, we were actively hostile to people when they came here. We treated them poorly. So, and the rest of the world, the developed world, picked up on that, and they started competing against us for the best and the brightest students. They started advertising towards them, and they started succeeding. So now we no longer get the best and the brightest. And that's a big strategic mistake. We also we shifted our position on trade. We're the only country in the world in the last 4 years, the only developed country that hasn't entered a free trade agreement or approved one. Europe, Asia, Canada, South America are furiously entering trade agreements, and we basically stopped 4 years ago. So a lot of the things we're doing, and then of course there's the issue of the deficit, which is the big issue. We've made a lot of mistakes thinking that we could just continue to spend our way out of trouble. So without an innovation-focused agenda, which I think focuses on some of these things as well as things like Spectrum and others, I think we need to change. And the biggest mistake I think we make as a country is we don't have a national policy. We don't have a focus on, some of the things we debate in our presidential campaigns are just not focusing on the big picture. I mean, the last presidential campaign, I think, is a great example. You had the case of one candidate arguing for a much bigger government and higher taxes for anyone making more than $250,000 a year, and you had the other candidate saying, I won't cut anything and I'm not going to tax anything. There was no discussion about the real issue of the deficit in any meaningful way. There was always the waste, fraud, and abuse canard, which everyone always talks about and says, we could do this. And even in the last election, not the presidential, but the congressional election that occurred a couple of months ago, it was waste, fraud, and abuse. There was no discussion about what will be cut. And I think the only one who's been willing to go forward and put forth anything serious is the Cato Institute, and also, frankly, the the Deficit Commission at least tried to tackle something, and they've been ignored ever since they've done it. We are the Consumer Electronics Association, I think, is the only association that actually embraced what the Deficit Commission has done, because we believe this is serious. So I think we're challenged now in a number of different ways, and I could give a lot of examples, but I'll let someone else say something.
Just ask one follow-up on this, and then Kevin will sort of take a shot at it. So you're dating kind of the beginning of the real problem with September 11th, 9/11?
It's definitely a defining pivotal point when we shifted how we treat people coming in from abroad, you know, having been a magnet for the smartest people in the world. You know, now they come here, and most of our graduates in hard sciences now still are not U.S. citizens, but instead of giving them a green card and saying please stay and you could become a citizen, we kick them out after they get their PhDs, and that is a serious problem we face. We're basically killing our seed corn. There's a lot of research which shows that some of the most entrepreneurial companies in the country have been founded by immigrants, and the book is dedicated to immigrants. I believe in immigration, and it's a very positive thing. And you know, most of the debate focuses on illegal immigration. I'm not talking about illegal immigration. I'm talking about immigration that's strategic that we should want.
Strategic immigration. Kevin, you want to chime in on this?
Yeah, and get to something about immigration. And I'm not a policy guy, so I won't say that I have any great ideas for policy. But it's more like a way to think about why this country has done what it's done in innovation and technology. So let me give a quick riff on how the structure of the book works, because it's basically about an economic model that says that if you take two extremes, you take this idea of high-fidelity products and services, they tend to be things, you think of things like Apple or like Tiffany or like McKinsey's consultants, it's really high-end, very rich, usually high profit margin, a very, very rich experience. The very opposite end of that on this sort of spectrum is what in the book we call very high convenience. So very high convenience types of things are ubiquitous. They're very easy to get, makes everything very, very simple and easy. And you think like Walmart or McDonald's or something like MP3 music files. These are on the very high end of convenience. And a lot of the things that tend to succeed and have great competitive advantages tend to be the ones that are either super fidelity or super convenient. And things that tend to fall in between, and the book gets into a lot more, you know, finer points of how all of this works, but things that tend to fall in between and are not quite enough of one or not quite enough of the other tend to be confused. They don't have a real strategy. They sort of like, you know, end up falling by the wayside and not... You know, music compact discs, it becomes something like that. Newspapers, my old industry, has struggled with this problem. And so that's sort of the basic story. Now, how does that apply to innovation in the U.S.? And I got thinking about this after we actually were going to do this panel, because this is not something that's actually in the book. And it suddenly occurred to me that what we've done, maybe contrary to what you might actually think when you first think about this, what we've done in the U.S. is we've created the highest convenience model, situation, for being able to innovate and start companies in the world. Now, you think about that in terms of this model, and what we've created is this way to get access to money, access to capital, that's, you know, more convenient, easier, simpler, quicker than any place else you could possibly go in the world. The other thing that happens here that is far different from anywhere in the world is the movement of skilled labor, the ability for people in Silicon Valley to jump from one company to another company, and for these immigrants to come in, people to come in from other countries and join. So these skilled people are available and easily movable and interchangeable into startups, into other companies where they need to be. And a third piece of that is that I think people tend to forget is that the social and career cost of failure here is minimal compared to anywhere else in the world. And all of these things combine to make this the most convenient model that's ever existed for innovation and starting companies. And so what I would encourage, I mean, we can get into, I have other things I can add to this, but I don't want to take up too much time on this one thing, but I would encourage that's a way to think about everything that should be done when it comes to policy or initiatives or anything about how to create innovation in this country.
Increase convenience.
Always, 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 this country has to be the most convenient model for creating innovation and creating companies and technology.
That's interesting.
Can I follow up on that?
Yeah, go ahead. Please do.
In your book, your earlier
book, Michael, I recall reading that you talk a lot about investment as important for innovation, and the U.S. really dominated the world in terms of venture capital.
Right.
You know, we had a way, you know, NASDAQ blossomed focusing on technology and innovation, and it was a way that you get in, you put money in, and you can get out. And, you know, that was great 10, 15 years ago, and
right.
we dominated the world, but now we're getting less than half of the venture capital. And part of it is that there's other exchanges which have opened up around the world, and you point this out in your book. But another part of it is the fact that we've enacted laws which make it more difficult to invest.
Right.
We have Sarbanes-Oxley, which meant well, but was really dealing with a few bad apples, which is a huge burden now. Especially for, you know, for a large company, it almost doesn't matter because it's just a rounding error. But for a smaller company that wants to go public or have a small market capitalization, it's a huge, I hear from a lot of our smaller publicly traded companies, and Sarbanes-Oxley is the difference between profit and loss to them. If they're spending $200,000 a year and their net income is $1 million, that's 20% of their revenue, which is going to Sarbanes-Oxley compliance. And it's an annual expenditure that's very large. So it meant well, but it's very harmful.
But you know what's interesting about Sarbanes-Oxley, and I point this out in some of the pieces I've written for PPI, it's an example of pro-cyclical regulation. It was put in 2002 when the tech industry was weak. Okay, it was like hammering home a nail. And what we've had now in the last couple of years is we actually have had more pro-cyclical regulation. We've had regulatory policy put on when the economy is weak on growing sectors. And you sort of say, you sort of ask yourself, growing innovative sectors, why should we regulate? Why should we put additional regulations on innovative sectors right now if we, what we want is more innovation and more jobs? And it's just an interesting thing. I went back, if you think about this in historical context, Sarbanes-Oxley, I remember arguments I had with people about Sarbanes-Oxley at that point. And so I said, why do you want to put these additional regulations on these companies that in fact have been the historical driver of growth at a point where they're really weak? What are you trying to accomplish here? And if you're talking about strategy, big picture strategy, And I love a lot of the stuff that you have in your book on this, but I think about this big picture strategy stuff as being tied to the business cycle as well. There are some things that you can do that are harmful to innovation, and if you do them in a downturn, you really end up pounding the industry. Okay, they're less harmful. They're always harmful, but they're less harmful if there's a boom. On the other hand, if we're in a situation like we're in right now, and you're trying to encourage innovation, you want to encourage innovation, you want to encourage growth, you want to encourage the industries that are generating jobs, then you sort of say, okay, this is the time when you actually want to focus the attention on encouraging industries that are innovative and growing and not on regulating them and penalizing them. And when I look and when I think about policy, I sort of say, okay.
Well, your point about that is a good one. And so on Sarbanes-Oxley, it's not only Sarbanes-Oxley itself, but you put that upon an existing culture of litigation here, which is always getting worse, and you have a litigation tax on every U.S. company, which doesn't exist elsewhere in the world. So there probably isn't a tech company around there whose CEO and CFO and top people haven't been diverted, publicly traded companies, because they've been sued in a class action every time their stock price changes a little. It's to the point of absurdity.
And Sarbanes-Oxley, which was supposed to avoid financial busts, didn't even work.
Well, and now you can't get a CEO to say anything publicly anymore because they're afraid of how they say and what they say. So the bottom line of it is if you want to encourage innovation, you have to make it easy for innovators. You have to make it easy for innovators to get investment. You have to make it easy for the people investing them to get out of it, to go public, to do all these things. Instead, we have an investment climate which favors the people who come in. They basically force a company to go into debt. Our financial system and tax system favors debt over equity now. So basically, you go into a healthy existing company, the stock price may not be high. You buy up the company, you sell off the assets, you unemploy the people, you increase the debt, and it becomes less of a going concern. But the people who bought it have cashed out and made a lot of money. They have no social responsibility, no anything. So again, everything in life, whether it's your own life, it's your business, and every business person, they do a SWOT analysis. The original start of this book was a SWOT analysis
right.
for the country. Strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. Everyone in business knows that. And it's a strategic plan for the country.
Now I'm going to sort of make you focus a little bit on just one. Suppose that a congressperson came to you and said, what's one thing that I can do right now? What's the most important thing that I can do to encourage innovation? What would you tell them?
Well, the most important thing they could do is do their job, which almost not one member
of Congress.
Not one member of Congress is really doing. I think we hire politicians and legislators to make tough decisions, and very few of them are, if any. You could point to a few, but their decision is to choose among competing priorities. That means you can't have two unwinnable wars, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, stimulus packages, bailouts, cash for clunkers, first-time homebuyers, and spend everything. You just can't do it. You must say, this is what is important to the future of our country. Is it education? Is it taking care of old people? Is it giving people health insurance? What is it that's important? Because right now, and as evidenced by the most recent deal that was signed by the president right before the new year, the deal was the Democrats and Republicans cut a deal where they basically said, we both agree that we want something, and we're not going to make a decision between the two. We're both going to give each other what we want, and we're going to burden the next generation.
Okay, I'm going to change the question then. Somebody has elected you to Congress. Okay? And what would, if you had to make a strategic decision about what to keep and what to cut and where to put the country's money, where would you put it?
Well, first of all, I recognize that anyone in this room, if they were the king, could balance the budget. I recognize that. Everyone has their own set of priorities. So I think if, judging by what I just say, I would measure everything by one standard, and that is every generation of Americans is sacrificed for the next generation. We're the first generation that's not sacrificing. Not only are we not sacrificing, but we're stealing from our kids. So our parents and their parents and their parents all sacrificed so we would have a better life. So the standard I always use is what's important for our children? Are we sacrificing for them? So I would take away a lot of this I feel good now stuff. You know, 2 years of unemployment compensation, you know, all these different things. Everybody has a right to something now in society. Over 50% of the population is getting money from the government. And I would just say, how do we invest in our children? How do we ensure that there's an infrastructure for them? How do we ensure there's education for them? You know, we wouldn't be in these wars. We wouldn't be spending a lot of the money we're spending if we use that as the criteria.
Now, I'm going to ask you,
what would you
do if you, what would be your first priority at this point to encourage innovation?
I'd go back to the same things I said in the opening statement. And so if we're really investing for the long term, and I agree with Gary that you know, okay, so we spend all this money to make sure people are, you know, whole or whatever, you know, whatever, you know, we've done, but it's not going towards making sure that companies can get access to capital and get, you know, and create new companies for innovation for the, you know, for the next generation for the long term. So if one of the problems is right now is that capital is frozen and, you know, and there's not enough of it, I mean, that obviously is one thing. You know, stop the money from going necessarily to these stopgap types of things and allow it to go someplace where it can flow into companies and into startups. If movement of labor and ability of skilled people to jump in and out of companies is really important, one of the things that has to change is, as also agreeing with my you know, congressional colleague here, that you know, that immigration policy has to change and we have to be able to allow those people in. But I'd also say something else that becomes important there are things like health insurance that is portable and has to be, you know, that would actually decrease the tension for jumping in and out of different companies. And the last thing, it really has to do with just making sure that there are jobs out there, because we're talking about this cost of failure being low in the U.S. Well, you know, it's low as long as you can fail and then find another job. If you fail at trying to start your company and you can't get anything else for the next 2 years, the cost of failure suddenly become increasingly high. So I guess my priorities would end up being, you know, getting capital to people like venture capitalists and freeing it up for startups, immigration policy, health, portable health care, trying to do something about, as you know, lots of people in Congress apparently are doing right now, the whole job situation.
I'm going to ask you another question, Kevin, and then I'm going to open it up to the people from the audience. When I was reading your book, and I was thinking about the trade-offs between quality and convenience. I was thinking about that as, I don't know, another way of thinking about it as high-end or low-end, okay? And I was thinking about U.S. economic strategy. I was thinking about U.S. economic strategy. U.S. could have a low-end, consumer-driven strategy, or it could have a high-end, more expensive knowledge capital, you know, educate everybody up the kazoo strategy. Do you think that that this kind of strategic choice is something is, you know, is the right way to sort of think about it? That we need to sort of figure it. You talk in the book about what was the not the belly it was
fidelity.
The fidelity belly. The idea that you don't want to get stuck in between. Seems like maybe the U.S. is getting stuck in between. You know, on the one hand, we need to have the high-end stuff in order to compete globally. On the other hand, we're paying for all the consumer stuff too.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you do as a country is you constantly, the U.S. is moving up the ladder on the intellectual capital sort of side of things, and increasingly, using manufacturing and other. Country. I mean, this is what's happening. There's a lot of people in this town who decry the loss of manufacturing, the loss of lower-level jobs, but that's essentially been, to me, like our de facto.
But we haven't moved up. We haven't done. We haven't done the investment that would be affiliated with moving up.
Well, okay, that may
that's
be the
kind
case.
Of your, that's kind of your choice so, because that we try to do everything. We're trying to spend on all the consumer stuff. We are not actually sort of saying, okay, we're going to prioritize. The investment in education. We're not saying we prioritize the investment in R&D in order to sort of fit the rest of this strategy. Because what I'm trying to fit what the two of you are sort of putting, saying together in one framework, mm-hmm. okay, which is what you would sort of say is you got to choose whether you're going high end or low end.
Right.
And what you're saying is that we're not choosing.
And I think we're high end. And here's why. I mean, we have three choices. Any country has three choices when you're in a financial situation we're in. You could either raise taxes, you can cut spending, or you could grow the economy. I personally think it would be a combination of the three, but growing the economy, I feel that we have some control over in terms of the direction we go in based on the strategy. The strategy for growing the economy is innovation. Innovation will grow the show. We have the world's best internet companies. We have the best, in many ways, the best technology companies, and not only in traditional technology, but biotechnology and other technology. We have the most innovative motion picture industry and music industry. We have great writers. We have everything you want. Plus, you have President Obama set a goal that by 2020, the U.S. shall have the highest percentage of its students attending college. So if you're sending all your kids to college, and you know a large number of them are now security guards or working in fast food places, who's going to be doing factory work? How many people in the audience have ever actually worked in a factory? I mean, I have. Is anyone else here? Only one other person. Let me tell you. When I worked in a factory, I lied about my age at the age of 14. It convinced me to go to college and get education. It stunk. Americans don't want to work at these repetitive jobs over and over again. We're bright people, and if you're educated, it's even more difficult. So there's an inconsistency in what the president wants, and this all this talk about, oh, we must have factory work return to the U.S. I think what we are is we are focused on innovation, and that's who we are, and that's what we should be. And that defines us.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And also, as far as inconsistency is concerned in this sort of fidelity, you know, convenience play, and going back to something that Gary said earlier, was that that one of the huge competitive advantages for the U.S. has always been that we have the highest fidelity universities in the world.
Right.
And that is that draws people from other parts of the world, the best and the brightest here. And it educates our citizens to be the best and the brightest. And anything that possibly endangers that is a gigantic competitive mistake for the U.S.
Absolutely. You know, 10 days ago, I moderated a panel with the CEOs of Cisco, General Electric, and Xerox. And this was the discussion. Is what are we good at? What are we bad at for innovation? And everyone agreed. We are number one with our universities and our graduate. That is our core strength. What are we bad at? Elementary, K-12 education by all objective measures. And that's where the level of investment should occur in those various strategies. So every time you figure out what you're good at, what you're bad at, what's the strategy to succeed?
Right. Okay, questions, comments? That fellow right back there. Could you say what your name is first?
Yeah, it's Garland Poole.
Okay.
Looking at is what they're doing over in Germany in terms of the what I call sort of the middle spot, which is we got away from the trade schools and we got away from the skilled worker set. It's interesting that we have automobile manufacturing, for example, in this country, from BMW, Mercedes, Toyota, etc. But the high-end cars, where they actually have coach work, where they have skilled workers, that's all done back home.
Right.
And I sat out over in Berlin some years back, and the guy who's got the biggest Mercedes and the biggest house on the entire table is not the guy from Deutsche Telekom, but it's this guy who does the local, you know, skilled craftsman. He did this for import and export. This tile work stuff, which is just absolutely stunning. In churches and homes, and he had this stuff for export. It was phenomenal. But the skill set that made this craftsman, the way he did it, and blazed it anyway. I'm absolutely all for the H-1B visas, and I think Gary Shapiro's exactly right. We need to absolutely address that, apart from also address the immigration issue. But why we're holding that H-1B visa and the green card hostage for the larger issue. But in addition to that, we have to look at this comprehensive education and say, is it right that we have all of this in this sort of high-end thought leadership?
So basically what you're saying is that you're talking about a middle as well.
Let's
give Gary a chance to sort of respond.
That's a good point. Germany was cited by this same panel, and everyone thought they'd point to China or somewhere else, but it was Germany was pointed as a model of what the U.S. could somewhat emulate in terms of strategies for innovation. But you're right. In terms of, I spend a lot of my life in Detroit, not in my life, last few years, and I'm there every week. My wife and I ran the same ad on Craigslist in Detroit in the U.S. Here I got one in Washington. I got one unqualified response. There I got hundreds. We simply wanted the inside of our garage just organized. We got this guy who actually had designed, and we had hundreds of responses in Detroit from incredibly qualified people. A lot of them retired early. They're the type of people you're talking about, craftsmen, highly trained, highly skilled. The guy we ended up hiring for the minimum wage had designed the inside of the Corvette. We have a precision-tuned garage at this point. and there's hundreds of people. There's a disconnect, honestly, geographically, between the skill levels of the people we need and where they're being sought. I mean, Detroit is full of highly skilled people that are unemployed and the kind of people you're talking about. But elsewhere in the United States, because the foreign car companies made a strategic decision not to be in a union environment. In the comeback, I talk about unions and having gone through this car check argument, the tech companies are the most concerned. We have 2,000 corporate members at CEA. From the smallest one-man company to the largest high-tech internet company, every CEO I talked to was concerned about car check. Why? Because union environment is inconsistent with innovation. Because they want to give equity to people. They don't want to give them rights not to be laid off or not to be able to flexible change their job. Unions have terrified innovators, and maybe rightly so, and it's a debate which has to occur. It's starting to occur. I think unions are starting to realize that you can't be anti-employer and be pro-worker and pro-jobs. I think that's even filtered over a little bit to some of the rhetoric used by the administration. I think what we're starting to see is more of a focus on the fact that employers create jobs. Employers are not bad. And that's the way I think we have to go. We have to start making this instead of an antagonistic environment, I think we have to get everyone on board with a strategy.
Innovation creates jobs.
I was just going to say, if I believe in the model in my book, I would say that I disagree with you and that we have to choose whether we're investing in the high end or we're investing in the low end, and investing in the middle is not the thing to do. And you're saying invest in the middle.
Let me just finish up something that's related to that. If you look at Germany, okay, one of the things that Germany has done is actually kept wage growth really low, okay? And their economic growth, if you looked at their economic growth numbers, they're actually quite weak. And so part of the reason why they were able to sort of stay competitive in terms of exports was, in fact, they took a choice about sort of lowering consumption levels there, okay? They made a choice, okay? They didn't try to do what the U.S. did, was try to maintain consumption levels at the same time as everything else was going on. And it's important to sort of, when you look at the German strategy, it's important to understand that this fits right into the idea of making a choice, okay? And any case.
But
Well, let me actually pick up questions from there. Yeah, we'll come back to you again. There was questions on this side over here.
Oh, is it being recorded?
You didn't tell us that. Okay.
You
so the next
back,
person,
right?
Next person. There was somebody who was in the back who had their hand up there. Other questions here?
There's a gentleman right here.
Oh, there. Okay. Okay. Well, it's okay. They'll make their way up there.
Hi, I'm Alex Gamron with the Senate Committee on Small Business, and you know, you guys keep bringing up regulation and free market, and like, you know, this is the problem. This is where we need to be, but you can't have zero regulation, and you can't just have way too much regulation. Where is that perfect balance where you can get that innovation yet have enough regulation to make sure we have the correct laws in?
I love that question, because as I was driving to work this morning, a huge ice chunk hit my windshield. As it was 20 feet in the air coming towards me, I said, oh boy, I hope they regulate windshield strength. It turns out that they do, and I survived, as did my windshield, thankfully. So I think it depends. I think you should state the goal in regulation. And the goal, for example, with windshields, which I know nothing about, was safety. And I imagine there's tests they have to meet. So when you set a safety goal, the way to do it is say, since we're involved, look, our organization is an ANSI-approved standard-setting organization. We do about 20 standards a year, and a lot of those are pro-innovation, have nothing to do with government. But where it's worked is when government has come to us and said, we want to get to objective A. How do we get there? The dangerous things and the things we hate is when the government says, you shall do something this way because we know better than you. But the objective is, let's say, a safe windshield, and that can withstand a 20-pound ice cube coming at you at 30 miles an hour. That's something that industry can respond to in creative ways, as long as you say what the and that's how we do all our standards. We don't say you shall build something a certain way. We say it shall perform a certain way. And I think if you boil down most objectives, there's obviously a higher need for safety-oriented regulations when there's a marketplace incentive for companies not to be safe in some ways, and the only backup may be litigation. I'd rather have a standard that companies can meet to. Another example is the transition to digital television. That was also one where industry and government partnered up, and they said, here's the objective. We want to make sure terrestrial broadcasters could get their signals without spending a lot more money. We want to have the best system in the world. And everyone got together, and it was a miracle. It occurred. We did it better than anyone in the world still. And that's the kind of model I think you should look at, is participatory. You go to industry and you say, here's what we're trying to accomplish. A lot of what we see are burdens on businesses. For example, in the last week, we got hit with two things on our way to Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. One is an old, outdated EEOC lawsuit, which had passed its filing time, and we were asked for about 10,000 zillion documents that are totally irrelevant for, I mean, it's just, I can't believe my government is doing this to me. And another is, for some reason we can't understand, we got a 401k audit. Both of them come in there, and they're asking for things which are inhumane to require an organization to produce in 15 days or 30 days. And it's just like, why is my government doing this to me? We're out there, we're trying to do good things, and all of a sudden the great power of government is saying, you have to do all these things. And we have 80% of our companies are small businesses. We run our trade show that anyone with an idea can expose it to literally hundreds of thousands of journalists, financiers, retailers, people from around the world. That's the whole purpose of our event. It's not for the big companies, it's for the tiniest company. So everything we do is aimed that way. So how do we do it? What can we do? Well, our own government makes it very difficult for foreign buyers to come here through our visa program. We treat people that are coming from overseas horribly. True. We can't get help even hosting the problem. Our own ethics rules bar our government officials from, we had 30,000 people from abroad. We need help hosting. We just need people to sign a letter from the White House, like the president, saying, will you come? It's very difficult to get that done in today's environment. Every other country in the world we're competing with, and we do have competitive trade shows, which our small businesses have to go exhibit at because they can't get the foreign buyers here, in a sense. We don't feel our government is working with us for the most part. We feel they're working against us. And every time there's a new rule, I think it should expire over a certain period of time. I think it's the same thing with laws. I think their purpose should be laid out and saying the purpose of this law is to do X, Y, Z, and then you measure it in 5 or 10 years, and if it's not working, let it die. You know, there's more rules on the books for small businesses, and there's more things out there. It's just very difficult. The American dream, let me just finish the concept. The American dream that you were talking about is that anyone with an idea can expose it and maybe get very wealthy, whether it's a Mark Zuckerberg or a Bill Gates or a Steve Jobs. And that's what's made us great, and we have to preserve that. And that requires tax structures, it requires investment, it requires government getting out of the way. And I know that sounds like Republican dogma, but the fact is, as long as we look at it from the entrepreneur perspective, if it's easy to start a business, if there's not, if there's there's not a litigation risk. If you can get investors, that's a good thing.
Let me give an answer which is really complimentary to your terrific answer. Okay. No, it's true, because I'm sitting here sort of saying this is all great stuff. Okay. Until today, cost-benefit analysis on regulations did not include innovation as a factor. Okay. Until Obama issued the new executive order today, okay, you could go and look at 100 cost-benefit analyses and not see innovation mentioned once. All right? And that's just astounding. Okay, because what it means is that the thing that's most important to us is not getting counted in, okay, to the regulations. Related to that, you talked about sunsetting regulations. Okay, we've got a proposal coming out soon for a regulatory improvement commission. Okay, which would be a BRAC type commission, the idea give you a systematic way of identifying and rolling back regulations that didn't work, and kind of in a very transparent process that allows us to assess, okay, in an independent way, what regulations are working and which ones aren't. It's kind of a different. There's a lot of people that are trying to get at this. This is a different way of getting at it. But at this point now, you can go and look at regulations, and what you see is that they're not promulgated with an eye to sort of what will reinforce innovation. And it's just a problem because you pile up enough of them. And I'll just give you one image that I like to use. Think of each regulation as a pebble. You throw a pebble into a stream, it doesn't have an effect. You throw two and it doesn't have any. You throw enough pebbles in and you've dammed it up, okay? And you can never tell which was the pebble that was the problem. Okay, because each individual pebble is justifiable. There's a reason for it. But then you end up piling them up in such a way that you've dammed up the stream. And this is kind of the frustration here, which is, and I'm if you sort of put me in a category, you know, with Gary in terms of my view about government, okay, you would sort of be further along than I would towards the less government end. But frankly, I look at the regulatory structure at this point, I sort of say this is just too much, and it's a lot of just being stuff being done without an idea about what's going on. Other questions, comments? Yes. Okay, now I have to ask you to go to the microphone.
This
and the
is
guy
a,
in the back will
a, a
be
person stage is Gary Arlen, noted consultant, journalist, and person who knows technology.
And thinker.
No, actually, I was going to introduce myself. Thank you, Gary. I was going to introduce myself as a convergence, quantum, sort of multi-platform, cross-platform kind of guy. And this is a question that involves a lot of this interaction between a lot of different pieces of this regulatory and business decisions. Look, Kevin, in your book, I was thinking of it the other day. I saw a piece in the Denver Post about the CES saying the products are never right the first time. They keep making them until they get them right. And that's okay. I mean, that's part of the iteration and the innovation iterative process. At the same time, I'm thinking about a lot of issues like that you're very involved with, Gary, on ecology and environmental clarity and making sure that these products find some home after use. So you take all of this together, and there's a lot of regulations in all these categories, especially in the environmental issues. How does a company, how does an individual start to think out how to play out a process of getting the product right so it's good for the customer early on, and there's an afterlife for it so it isn't just adding to this pile of junk that's really causing a lot of consumer distress and municipal distress in many cases.
So think about, again, with the trade-off and the fidelity convenience model. So most new technologies that get invented or introduced start off in this no man's land of not being good enough fidelity to good enough of an experience to make any worth it for anybody, nor is it very easy to get or inexpensive or anything for anybody. I mean, the first digital camera that was invented, you know, was whatever it was, $7,000 and took five pictures and was not enough of any of those things. And if you think about tablet computers, I mean, this is a good example. I mean, tablets have been around for, a decade, more, and nobody has been able to get it right. It's been sitting in this place in the middle where the experience of having it wasn't anything particularly better than having a laptop or anything else. They cost a lot. They certainly weren't some other kind of like very convenient type of solution that was going to maybe cost, you know, a third of the price of a laptop and easy to carry around. It was just sitting there in this middle zone that was crappy. Apple comes along and it says, you know what, we can make a tablet that's a super experience. It costs a lot, $600 for that stupid little thing, you know. I mean, it's too much money.
Don't say that. They'll come and get you.
But they came in and they consciously made a decision that we're going to migrate this product out from this, you know, Fidelity Valley, to use the term in the book, and up to this super high fidelity, super high experience device that you can carry around. And we can, and if we make it that high experience, that high fidelity thing, we can charge $600 for it, and people will actually pay it. And so now Apple's chore from now on is to say, okay, we have to continue to make this, the absolute super high fidelity mobile gadget for you to carry around, because somebody else is going to come along and make one higher fidelity if they don't keep investing in it in that direction. So Apple has to make this conscious decision and say, that's what we do. We make super high fidelity products. We have to keep investing in it in that direction. We can't invest in it so it, like, you know, tries to do all things to all people or, you know, in that direction. Somebody else comes along and, HTC in China comes along and looks at this tablet market and says, you know, well, we can't compete. We're not going to compete against Apple. We're not going to get those buyers that do want that. You know what we can do? We can come along and we can make the super high convenience version of a tablet. We can make one that costs you $100. You can practically throw it away if it breaks. But you know what? It's still going to work good enough, and you're going to want to carry it. So we'll go out on that end. And somebody like Samsung is going to come along and have something that costs maybe like, you know, half the price of an Apple, but it doesn't work quite as well, and not as inexpensive, and maybe works a little bit better than the HTC product. And the Samsung thing is going to fail, and five people are going to buy it. So the point, to get to Gary's answer, at least from my perspective, is that these new technology is always going to start off in this no man's land. Then decisions have to be made about what is it going to be. Is it going to be this? Going to invest in it to go in this fidelity direction, you invest in it to go in this convenience direction, and make a decision and go that way, and keep investing in it to keep pushing it out in that direction, because somebody else is going to come along and compete with you in that direction if you don't. And if you don't, and otherwise you let it end up sitting in this middle zone, and it starts to become, uninteresting to most people.
Could I take a totally different tack on that? And I understand what you're saying, and it could be this fidelity could be recyclability for a product for some people. But I would take a different tack. Is that there's two types of and essentially products someone could introduce in our space. One is internet or based or software based, no barriers to entry, no real environmental issues. Then there's actual the product. Eventually, at some point, you have to have something that's the technology you have to use in your hand. And it does raise environmental issues, and there's at least two. One is energy usage, which I think we're really doing better at every year, and you know, the TV set today is 90 times better and uses a heck of a lot less energy than one of just 10 years ago. But the other issue is what we call end of or use or life cycle issues, or recycling, as some people call it. Well, the challenge is, if you think about it from an entrepreneur's point of view, if you introduce a product now, you have to deal with 50 different states and many cases, different localities, you have to put up money, you have to put up insurance, you have to put up bonds. The recycling alone is considered a barrier to entry now for innovators. There's no question. It is a huge barrier
That's
to entry.
That's interesting.
So the answer to me is though, as much as I say, you know, be careful what you get involved in, this is Congress's job to come in and have a national recycling law. Tell us what it is, have one national standard. The U.S. is a big enough market. If you know what the rules are, you could comply with them. But this is a case where it's just a huge barrier to entry. There's another now new barrier to entry that Congress just put on last year, and that is compliance for the disabled community. I don't know how you could design a product. You know, originally the first proposal was to design every product must be accessible by every disabled person no matter what. And it's gotten modified from that, but it is a barrier to entry for innovators. And I don't know how you could be an innovator or a funder and say, wow, we have to comply with this new law. You have to have a focus group of disabled people before you sell. I mean, there's all sorts of new things that have to happen, and some of them will be rule-based, but those are issues for our future.
If now I have to go back and ask you the question I asked you before. Okay, if you had your druthers at this point, okay, what would you do? Would you
in what area?
Well, I mean, in this, you actually just said what you would do in the area of recycling.
I'm a kiddie, give me one wish. I want 10 more wishes. I mean, you know, what is
you
it?
You can have 10 more wishes if you want, Gary. That's okay by me. No, what I'm trying to think about here is that you know, we're in Washington. where people have to decide, okay, they have to actually put a piece of legislation through, okay? And the question, and one of them, and actually you just gave one, which was a national recycling law, okay? If you had to sort of say what you would have government do at this point, what would it be? I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I'm just trying to sort of just focus a little bit about what I'm trying to put him on the spot.
He liked your question.
Okay.
What would government do in which area?
Yeah, well, look, I can give you free rein about picking whichever area you want. I did read the whole book.
Okay? Well, actually, I did. One of the more controversial things I suggest in there is, well, there's a few, obviously, in the immigration area that are somewhat controversial, making English the official language and having certain classes of people in and not allowing others, even though our Constitution appears to allow it. In the whole immigration, there's a whole bunch of very specific things. In the area of, I do believe we have to make investments in the future in infrastructure, and I propose a 5-cent, and this is an idea that others have had, just borrowing it. It's a 5-cent per gallon increase in tax that goes up every 6 months. That'll encourage energy-efficient cars, and it'll create a fund for infrastructure, which I think is sorely needed. We're in trouble, and we're not investing in infrastructure. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to... You know, the thing is, I think there's two types of people in the world, those who, have, as I say, factory workers and none, and I've seen factories around the world, but those who have traveled around the world and those who haven't, if you've traveled around the world and you've been to China and other countries, you see the enormous investment in infrastructure, and you understand why they're getting ahead of us. But you also see I've seen the poverty of India, and you realize, you know, the fact that we take certain things for granted, like running water and electricity, and those things could be endangered. So we're facing some real major challenges that it's politically expedient to ignore. And, you know, shame on us for being that way.
That was one of the things that came across in your book, you know, the political expediency. Yes?
Thank you, Nigel Cameron. I suppose my question is, in the scheme of things, what are the trends? I mean, how is this going? I mean, in 10 years' time, how is it going to look? Now, we're all throwing up all sorts of random ideas, and I throw out random ideas in my commentaries about some of these things. For example, that you could destroy tenure in the universities with an appropriations rider. That would be a nice deal. you could require all of the political appointees to be fired tomorrow morning and to have to requalify sitting in the innovation, change, management, openness test. I mean, there are things that can be done that don't actually require primary legislation. But what I would like to ask is how in the scheme of things in 10 years' time, what do we expect to be? You know, I mean, we have the National Nanotechnology Initiative, which I think is a very good example of the problem of federal science policymaking. Going for 10 years, every 3 years, it stops, and they write a new strategic plan for the next 3 years. And these are very good people, and it's $1.8 billion. A lot of good things are going on there. We had a conference on this recently, and I said, in 10 years' time, will this be still every 3 years, we write a new 3-year strategic plan? Now, are we really going to transform, are we going to innovate the innovation conversation in government, or are we really just going around in circles?
Well... All right,
the short answer is we're going around in circles. Now we'll go to the long answer.
I've been a technology journalist and author and writer for 25 years. I'm not a Washington guy. I'm not a policy guy. I'm not a strategic plan believer. And I'll just tell you one reason why, and it has something to do with the next book that I'm doing. That's actually finishing up this month. There's a fascinating emerging area of technology that is the intersection between brain science and computer science. Computers technology is the microprocessor-based computer technology that we've run on for the last 50 years is running out of steam. It can't get that much better. There has to be a new development in computing technology to make it get better, keep up with the deluge of data that we're creating and all of the stuff that's going on. And one of the most promising paths has to do with making computers that work a lot more like human brains. So this is not on anybody's radar in Washington, I guarantee you, except for DARPA, who actually is funding a project called Synapse to try to promote some of the developments in this area. It's emerging out of the ether. It's emerging out of the things that are being done in a bunch of startups and a bunch of university labs at Stanford and Carnegie Mellon. MIT, it's emerging out of things that the big companies like IBM are investing in. And, you'll see a little bit of this when you tune on your TV in February and see an IBM computer play against the two Jeopardy champions on live television. So, you know, I mean, these things, the internet was, you know, something that evolved out of some government policies, but the web, this thing that blew up in the 1995 to 2000 timeframe, was not on anybody's agenda. It wasn't a part of anybody's strategic plan. So there's got to be a way, and again, speaking as a non-Washington person, whatever, you know, there's got to be a way to let Washington, you know, and the regulations stay out of the way so that these things, and encourage these things that pop up on their own like this to really, you know, evolve and flourish, which is, actually I think we've been pretty good at for the most part.
Thanks, Nigel, for your question. It's a good question, and it seems like a very smart question, especially with that British accent.
It always makes it seem smarter.
15 IQ points extra just for that. But it's a serious question, and you raised points, some rather interesting ideas, having served on a college board and raised that issue about tenure. Boy, it's not a very popular issue with universities. But you raised a point about the education system having some challenges. Your question was, where should government make investment to make innovation occur? And I'm kind of with Kevin on that. I don't think, you know, we ask our government to do a lot of things. I don't think that kind of decision should be made for government. The first stimulus package had literally billions of dollars that 26-year-old kids in the administration are now deciding where it goes.
That really wasn't my question.
I'm sorry?
My question wasn't about whether government puts funding.
Well, your question was whether they have a long-term plan. 3 year versus 10 years, and they're spending money over a 3 year period, and that was part of the stimulus package, and that's what that money is going. Well, that's a different issue. I don't think it's the government's job, and then in my view, to make decisions like that. I would rather they give the money on a matching basis to venture capitalists, and both of them have skin in the game, and they decide where it goes, just for the same reason that Kevin's talking about. We don't know where the next innovations are to come from, but I do know that I'm pretty sure the government isn't going to be the ones that create them. Now, it could be as a result of defense spending or some other investment that's necessary, or the space program. You get spin-offs, which are important and valuable and have commercial value. But I don't think the government choosing, for example, to invest in things as they did in the stimulus package is a good idea, especially when I know for a fact that kids are making the decision compared to people who have venture capital experience. So we're wasting a lot of money. And I do agree with you, which I think you're saying, is that 3 years is a very short planning cycle for anything long-term. When we do our business planning, we're focusing on the long-term, where we want to be 5 to 10 years from now with things we do. And most businesses are either trying to survive or trying to figure out where they want to go, because if you don't know where you want to go, that's where you'll end up. So I agree with you on that. I just don't think government is equipped to make those decisions. CEA has never advocated for any government spending on almost anything. So we're pretty consistent in that, because we're willing to say, you know, there's certain priorities a society should have, and funding business is not one of them. On the other hand, you know, we'd be happier. One of our competitiveness issues and where you start a business has to do with tax rates and things like that. So those are important issues.
Let me just one thing that you asked, Nigel, about trends. There's one thing that we have been kind of continuous about, which is investing in healthcare research. Okay, and I put together a chart where basically if you look at U.S. R&D investments, it's one-third IT, one-third biosciences, one-third everything else. We don't invest in energy, we don't invest in materials, we invest in IT, and we invest in biosciences. The IT investments, corporate and some government, have paid off. The biosciences investment have not paid off proportionate to the amount of money we put in. Okay, and that's a very big, and that's a really, really big issue. It's a combination of regulation. It's a combination of the stuff being really hard. It's a combination of the corporate culture. And the question you want to ask yourself in terms of trends at this point is this going to change? Are we going to see some of the payoffs from this that we had hoped for over the next 10 years? Is there something that we should be doing different in a regulatory basis that would make a difference? But at the end of the day, there's two games in town for the U.S., And one of them is not energy, okay? One of them is IT, represented by Gary over here, okay? And then one of them is biosciences. And so, you know, there's the discussion, and obviously today, because of the State of the Net conference, is about IT-related stuff. But I can tell you that I've gone to a lot of innovation-related conferences over the last year
We are many, 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 many CEOs and corporate people on the panel, okay, and what you get is a lot of IT and communications and consumer electronics people, and then no pharmaceutical or biotech people, because that's kind of fallen off the map. So if you're thinking about things that have potential that aren't there at this point, that have been sort of fallen off the map, that's kind of the big one, where you have to ask the question whether or not the corporate culture. No, I understand. I understand. We can have a long, different discussion about that. Okay, in terms, but I think in terms of what we had sort of expected to happen, given the amount of money that the government has been funneling into it. Okay.
Actually, I almost feel more comfortable talking about that, the investment in medical and bio, than I do in IT. I mean, obviously, a government should invest in IT to the extent it's improving its own level of service, and the government is the biggest purchaser. That's just a fact, and they should be doing it right, and we applaud that. And having just come from a conference where I was dealing with people around the world, especially in Africa and Russia, and their biggest problem is corruption, we have to be somewhat happier that our government is doing things right, and there's very little corruption, at least in my mind, at least at the federal level, in terms of IT purchasing and other purchasing. So the rest of the world is buying things at a very, or these areas, they feel they're buying things at a very inflated cost compared to what they get, because everyone takes their cut along the way. So in one area, we're doing it right. Our procurement process at least appears to me to be very honest. But in bio and in medicine, I talk about healthcare a little bit, maybe because I hear so much about it from my wife, who's a surgeon, and all the colleagues I spend a lot of time with who are doctors. The healthcare bill was in part passed on the basis that the U.S. is somehow inferior in terms of their healthcare compared to other countries, based on a whole bunch of statistics, which ignored the fact that we're a diverse culture where we have a lot of very overweight people that choose to have a lifestyle choice, and we have a lot of women having kids actually when they're girls, a lot of 16-year-old pregnancies. So we have lower birth weights, we have lower ages, we have lower lifespans, and we were being measured by, I feel, a very unfair barometer compared to homogeneous societies where perhaps people are healthier and they choose to be healthier. So the basis of the bill wasn't fair. The other thing that the bill did, in my view, is that it discriminated heavily against those that are specialists in favor of generalists. And specialists actually are the ones that do a lot of the research and have made the U.S. the leader in the world in terms of breakthroughs. And if you read any medical journal in the world, you'll see most of the contributions are from U.S. doctors, specialists. Every specialist group opposed the healthcare bill, and the AMA supported it. So the concern I have is that if the healthcare bill is left where it is, our ability to be at the top of the world will go down. And we are at the top of the world, not only in terms of, it's just not about drugs, it's about surgical techniques, it's about all sorts of innovations and breakthroughs which can either extend life, for a few more months, which you can argue about whether it's worthwhile, and there's a lot of arguments both ways, or just actually cures. And I think those cures are very important. And I think we should have a policy which says, what are we really trying to do with our health care? Is it just trying to keep people alive for a few more months? Is it trying to have the best health care in the world by some rather measures which don't really measure anything, or is it to be what we have been at least until now, which is the best, most innovative country in the world? It's a reason that everyone else who's rich from around the world comes here for their health care when they're in serious trouble.
Eric Magdans with Department of State. My question is, there's some concern about, domestic concern about students, graduate students coming from India, from China, studying here, getting trained, and then returning back to their high-growth countries and being able to leapfrog us in terms of innovation. Additionally, there's a concern that the U.S. government, as well as some companies, are investing in innovation overseas in India, China, the Middle East, trying to build up the innovation process in other countries, helping Russia, for example, improve and reduce their corruption so they can be more innovative. Do you agree that, is that concern unfounded? And I'd like your thoughts on that. Thanks.
Well, I guess I just would make one thing about comment about the universities is, that to me is a no-brainer. I mean, if we're going to have 1,000 people from China come over to our universities and 500 of them stay and 5 of them go back, isn't that better than none of them coming over from China and we don't have any of them and they're the best and the brightest in the world? So great. You know, I mean, if it makes our universities better, if it makes our brand better, that's, I'm all for it. I don't know, I'm going to throw the other one to Gary.
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I think if China rises, if India rises, I don't think that's bad for us. I think it's good for the world. You know, what we really want is a better world for everyone. I'm an American exceptionalist, and I believe in this country, and I'm willing to do anything for it. But I do believe that other countries should be able to rise. The challenges are we going down, and I think you identify one of our weaknesses is that people go back. But we're kicking them out. We're not even inviting them to stay, just to put that on the table. And education, although it's not, I don't think it's counted that way officially, is actually a major export of ours. We make money being on a university board. You always like the state one anyhow. You like the out-of-state, out-of-country students because you could charge them more. So you're making money on those students. But in terms of, as a strategy, we should try to get them to stay. I totally agree with that. In terms of them being trained by us, I think that's a good thing. I think it's good for cultural understanding. I think our challenge is to try to seduce them to stay, not kick them out. And that's what it's all about. As to companies innovating and investing overseas. So you're a U.S. company. You're a CEO, and you're an American citizen. You're patriotic. You want to do what's best for your country, but you have to do what's best for your company. You have to go internationally to expand your growth, first of all. There's a lot of argument to be said you should be investing internationally because you want to be near your home country, near your country you're trying to sell. You have to hire some of their people. But the question then becomes, where do you invest? Well, part of it is the tax laws. We don't allow companies to repatriate. We're one of the few countries in the world that the double taxes. So you have to leave the money overseas anyhow. You can't bring it back, otherwise you won't have any of it left. So you have all this money overseas. Meanwhile, you have many other countries like Singapore. Singapore, if you invest $300 million, let's say, in a factory in Singapore, they'll give you back $300 million over a three-year period. Totally even. Plus, they've attracted a lot of the smartest people in the world there. They have a national strategy to do that. Other countries in the world have similar things where they're encouraging you. So you're a U.S. company, but wait, your own country won't let you hire the best and brightest people you want if they're from outside the United States. They tax you on the money you bring back to the United States doubly, so it doesn't pay to bring it back. Other countries are incentivizing you to invest that country elsewhere. You'd have to be financially crazy to actually do everything in the United States and invest here. That's when I say when our own government and strategy works against us, we operate as if we're the only ones here and we're the best and we'll always be the best. The fact is, we are the best today, but we're not going to be the best tomorrow because we're so arrogant. We are the top of our empire, and we are in decline, and it is a simple fact. And everyone else in the world can see it, but we can't. But I believe still the American people are honest, and maybe we'll have this type of honest dialogue. And that's why, in a sense, I raise these issues, because I think they're incredibly important to our country. I mean, we're a country where we're sending kids to Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're losing limbs. We can't even have a national honest dialogue on what's important for the country. And I think it's tragic, and I'm lucky that I'm privileged enough to be in my position and have the support of my organization to try to raise some of these issues. But I think it's an obligation for everyone to talk about them.
No, it's all good. It's all good. So I'm sort of sitting here thinking about how much I agree with you on these things, okay? And I might or might not agree with you on particular proposals, but the concept that we have to be focused on kind of what's important. So what you did is you pulled out one thing when there's a lot of different pieces involved that kind of accumulate on each other, that push people in different decisions. Yes.
Good afternoon. I'm looking forward to interviewing each one of you individually. Keith Moore from Open Government TV. The question that I have for all the panel, we'd love to have the audience hear your answer. The president on the first day of office said that he wanted to open up government. You all are familiar with the Open Government Directive. How much of all of America's problems today economically are based in a branding confusion?
What do you mean a branding confusion?
Where we're not branding our strengths after such a leadership statement on the first day of office that gave opportunity, paved the way, and opened up for new innovation, collaborations, so that people who never participated before could actually engage. Especially when you have other leaders fanning, you know, being fan members to the open government like Vivek Kundra and Anish Chopra, who say that You know, open government is not about technology. It's about agencies' mission. So if we could get agencies to do what they haven't done before, which is to open up, be transparent, and create collaborations, we could really begin to go back to our strengths and brand that, market that. And I'm not sure that we have as much of a problem that we seem to be having here. Tell me if you agree with that.
Go ahead.
Thanks, Keith. I appreciate that. I think there's been an inconsistency, frankly, between the statement and the actual openness. And in some ways, they've been very open. You know, you can read White House visitor logs and things like that. But the actual type of, and I'm a big fan of Anish Chopra and Vivek. I think they're the kind of technology leadership, frankly, we need in a country. But the actual transparency in terms of what's going on, I mean, the fact is, I think that we have in all sorts of agencies people with a what they view as a mandate to regulate. And I think that the problem that we faced in the last 2 years in the business community, where we had Congress basically, you know, doing very super activist in regulating the business community, is now shifted to the agencies. And I think there's a battle going on. There's going to be more lawsuits than you've ever seen. I don't think it's participatory. I don't think it's collaborative. I think it's antagonistic. I talk to my colleagues in many different industries, and they've never been so concerned in their lifetimes about what's going on in the agencies. And it's not exactly the type of openness and collaboration that I think that maybe the president envisioned. Mm-hmm. Certainly the White House has done a lot to be open, but I think some of it has not been executed well by the agencies.
Anyone else?
I'm just going to say two words here, which is I think what openness does is it sort of shows, will actually show there's a lot of disparity and there isn't a lot of agreement about what the goals are, okay? And that part of the reason why you end up without the transparency is it's a way of concealing the fact that there are people who, in fact, are not concerned with innovation. They're not concerned with growth, okay? They really care much more about the regulation than they do about the growth and innovation. And I would sort of say at this point, in this culture right here, there is a vast split between the people who say they're concerned about innovation and growth but really aren't. They're really much more, if you look at what they do, they're much more about the regulation, and then the much smaller number of people who are genuinely believe that growth is kind of where the country sort of needs to be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what you would get is, you know, if you had real openness, is a massive continual argument, which might be the best thing. Any case, I think we've come to the end of the session. I want to thank Gary. I want to thank Kevin. This has been terrific. I hope that the audience found this, you guys found this interesting, because I certainly did. And it's great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody.